Now, you'll remember Dr. Michael Mosley with his 5x2 diet on The Science Show and SBS Television, now repeated on BBC Knowledge. The point about Michael is he's a doctor, and so's his wife. So he knows the science and what your GP gets up to, on the other hand. Could there be a gap? Michael, we talked last time a few weeks ago about the diet. Are you still on the diet?
I am. I'm actually doing a sort of variant at the moment, what I would describe as 6-1. So I do it once a week these days because the research suggests that you can retain the benefits and also keep the weight off doing that. And there was a danger I was getting too skinny. I'm now about 12 kilos lighter than I was when I started, and there comes a point where you have to choose between your face and your body.
So you're not being a recidivist?
I am not at all, but I don't want to get super skinny because I think that's probably unhealthy as well.
What do you do on the one day?
I basically have scrambled eggs and a bit of ham for breakfast, and then I skip lunch, and then I have a big pile of vegetables and a bit of salmon or something like that in the evening.
How secure are you in the science of what you're doing, given the variety of information there is everywhere?
I am confident that intermittent fasting does bring benefits. It is particularly powerful and compelling when it comes to insulin sensitivity, and that was my motivation in the first place, because I didn't get on this to lose weight. I got into it because I was told by my doctor I was a diabetic. And my dad died of diabetes-related illnesses, so I wanted to do something about it. So I think that's quite compelling. I think the evidence that going on an intermittent fasting regime might reduce your risk of dementia is enough to kind of motivate me to do it, and it's certainly enough to motivate the people who study dementia to do it. But I think it's going to take 40 years and numerous trials before you have compelling evidence. In the area of nutrition, it is incredibly difficult to prove anything, just simply because you need huge numbers. So I would never claim that anything like this is even remotely proven. But I think there is a kind of a body of evidence that is building up.
On the other hand, you could have taken a kind of relaxed point of view and said, well, my father was, what was he, 72 when he died?
He was 72, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Mm. And given the kind of extra time you might have lived anyway, you could have coasted through, surely.
But I don't want to become diabetic because of all the complications. I look at the figures. I don't be impotent particularly. And I know my father, God rest him, was impotent towards the end. There are also various cancers associated. He had prostate cancer. I have an increased risk of that. When I had the test done before I got into this, my IGF-1 levels were very high, and those have all come down as well. So all the biomarkers have improved. Now, in Britain, we live a good long time, but the trouble is we live in ill health for the last 20 years. I don't particularly want to live till 90, but I do want to live in maximum health. You know, I want to be happy, cheerful, getting around. I don't want to be popping 16 pills like the average European at the age of 65.
Do you know, there's a paradox, and it's represented by these programs that, well, to some extent that you do, and I certainly do, where we have frontline medicine telling us all sorts of things about genomes, about proteins that can be given in different drugs and so on, and all this wonder stuff. And yet you look to the high street where the doctors are, how many of the doctors actually know any of that or act upon it? And how can people like us actually get into the doctors? I know the last time I went, I had to make 3 attempts at booking. By the time I had 4 minutes consultation, or was it 3.5? That was $75 plus 55 for the drugs. You know, the gap between the high-powered science and the everyday stuff that's happening in the street is colossal, is it not?
It is, absolutely. And there is a huge gap in knowledge as well, because I don't know what the average gap is. It's probably about 10 years between what the scientists know, what the doctors and the nutritionists find out, and what the general public eventually get told. And by that time, the science has probably moved on hugely. But the thing that encourages me is eventually it does get through. I think the only way you can really get to grips with it is by listening to wonderful programs like this one, buying wonderful books like mine, and you will find out what the scientists really think now without having to have it mediated via the doctors, if you like. In this world of the internet, where I think after porn, health is the second most searched for thing, the important thing is to go to places where you can actually trust the information. There's an awful lot of nonsense out there.
Tell me, what do you tell your wife, who's a GP, about this gap and whether she actually knows anything about what she's talking about?
Oh, we talk all the time, and she's really, really helpful, and she loves the knowledge. She says she finds it very frustrating that patients come in from the diabetic clinic and they're still being told rubbish. She saw somebody the other day, diabetic, sugars all over the place. That's because he's eating white bread and lots of rice, and that's because that's the information he's been given by some diabetic website. And she's saying to him, you might as well just be ladling sugar in yourself. Nobody has told him any better. And she finds that incredibly frustrating.
Do you know, from the University of Queensland, and I got the information about 6 weeks ago, the figure for how many Australians actually eat regularly fresh fruit and veg, it's 5.7% of the population.
Yeah,
that's really minuscule.
That is absolutely depressing as hell, I have to say. And I also understand it. Now, one of the reasons that I got into intermittent fasting is we have not got used to being hungry. I think one of the things that happens when you're hungry is then you might actually reach for a vegetable. You might obviously reach for a pastry or a bar of chocolate, but if you can be persuaded to reach for a vegetable, you discover vegetables are actually quite nice and that they'll fill you up. And I think that's the real challenge for education is going forward. How do you get the message out there in a way that actually compels people to act, as opposed to just going nah, 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 and closing off their ears?
Yes, we thought we knew about what's good food, but what, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, we thought that a nice big glass of orange juice, fresh OJ was good for you.
Yes.
And you come along and tell us otherwise.
No, I mean, compared to some of the things you could consume, I suspect it's not bad. But the trouble is, fibre is king. It's really about fibre. And the problem with orange juice and apple juice, that when you just drink it as a fluid, you might as well be just having a big sugar hit. There's about 6 to 7 teaspoons, if not tablespoons, in some of these things. And that just sends your blood glucose levels crazy. And also we know that if you eat an apple, it will kind of fill you up. If you drink an apple juice, it will have no impact whatsoever on the next meal you eat. So what's happened is the kind of 5-a-day campaign has been hijacked, of which apple juice, orange juice and smoothies is, I'm not a fan at all, but there are worse things like tin spaghetti hoops that will call themselves 5-a-day, but which are just packed full of rubbish. And that's the trouble, is the health message is immediately the food industry gets out there and they find a way to turn what is actually not a bad idea into a terrible idea.
Yeah.
How did our ancestors do things? Well, they had periods of feast and famine. When they exercised, did they really exercise? No, what they did is they did a lot of walking. Hunter-gatherers do walking and they do it out in the sunshine. Sunshine is actually quite good for you. Vitamin D is good for you.
And also to pedal quite a lot, because you demonstrate wonderfully in one of the films how you can pedal like crazy for 2 minutes,
yes,
or is it 3 minutes a week, with intense effort, and that apparently does you. It clears out the glycogen, it really sets up the body, and it doesn't give you a heart attack.
Is absolutely. That right? That's really interesting, because again, hunter-gatherers, when you observe them, they do have short periods where they sprint, whether it is running away from something or it's trying to capture something. They do have these moments where they go for it, although most of the time they're not doing that. It's not long sustained running, it's short bursts. And this is what they call high intensity training, or HIIT. Most athletes have been doing it for an awful long time, but it's now entering the mainstream. And the idea is that possibly doing lots of low-impact exercise is not the best way to go. That what you want to do is increase general activity, get off your bottom every 20 minutes or so, walk those stairs, increase the amount of time you walk, but intersperse that with short bursts of really quite intense stuff. So I get on the bike, I pedal like crazy for 20 seconds, breather, 20 seconds, breather, 20 seconds, and that's it. And one of the programs, The Truth About Exercise, you see me do that, extremely skeptical, I have to say, that it would have any difference, but actually the changes were quite profound in just 4 weeks. Now, this is early days, and again, rather like the intermittent fasting, we don't really know what the long-term impacts are, but certainly in terms of the biomarkers, it's very impressive.
And Michael Mosley's book is also impressive. It's called The Fast Diet, and his series continues on BBC Knowledge. While you're counting calories and doing the maths, try listening to Occam's Razor this week, presented by Stephanie Pradier from the University of Melbourne. She's also studying physics there. Her talk tells you why you should know maths, whoever you are.
From engineering to the physical sciences, from economics to drug development, mathematically literate people play an essential and crucial role. In July this year, Professor Ian Chubb, our chief scientist, emphasised this point when he opened the Massive Planet Earth conference. Professor Chubb said, "Mathematics is the only subject whose study consistently enhances performance across all fields of science." He followed this up in August, unveiling a strategy for the future of science, technology, engineering and mathematics, known by the acronym STEM. Professor Chubb calls for a better Australia in the national interest, with a widespread increase in STEM literacy. He spoke of a survey conducted by the Australian Industry Group, which found that a quarter of employers said the biggest barrier to recruitment was a lack of applicants with STEM skills. And looking ahead, what will the repercussions of this shortage be? A Monash University Centre of Policy Study has projected that the need for PhD graduates in the mathematical sciences will increase by 55.6% by the year 2020. That's in 7 years' time. At the rate we're going, Hawthorne has better odds of winning the next seven premierships, even without Buddy. But if our high school kids aren't taking mathematics, how on earth are we going to meet this demand? Though the nerd stigma associated with math, stats and science is beginning to lift, why are kids still steering clear of these subjects?
Stephanie Pradier presenting Occam's Razor on Maths. Occam's is on Sundays at 7:45 in the morning after Correspondence Report on RN, or any time online by going to the Radio National website. Catalyst on Thursday next is something Dr. Michael Mosley would like to see, and of course you must watch. It's The Truth Behind Cholesterol, presented by Dr. Marianne DeMaisy, a series of two. And next week on The Science Show, Bones, a pliosaur more than 4 metres long, and also the biggest dinosaur bird footprints ever found here in Australia. Production by David Fisher and Andrei Shobanov. I'm Robin Williams.